So this is Sarah Reith with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. It's July 5th, 2019, and we're in Potter Valley. Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Anand Forrest, and I live on Mid Mountain, and I've lived here a long time.
Can you talk about what you were doing before you came out here and why you decided to come to Potter Valley?
Well, actually, my partner and I were weavers, and we had lived on the coast on a commune long enough to realize that we weren't cut out for communal living, and so we packed it out down to San Francisco and sold our weaving on the street. I mean, it was 1968, duh. And we made a pretty good little pile of money spending next to nothing on living there, because you could rent for $50 a month, you know, utilities paid, just don't tell anyone. And we saved up $800. We were reading a book called A Reverence for Wood. Don't remember who wrote it, but the first chapter got into the sound of the words in different countries. In the Scandinavian countries, it's called timber. And in the United States, it's called lumber. I mean, hear it. It's different. So we would take up to Mendocino County, because we knew we couldn't afford on the coast, inland, just about every weekend to look at this and that. And we had another dry run, and we were going out of Ukiah, and we saw a sign that said United Land and Timber. And believers in show me a sign, we stopped, walked in, told the guy exactly what we wanted. He said, I got exactly what you want. Drove us up to Mid Mountain, and boy, we bought before we saw the land that we were actually going to buy. It was, we were going to live in paradise, and it was $125 an acre. So, you know, the payments were $88.83 a month, and I could panhandle that. So, you know, what's not to like? We packed it up and moved on out.
Weren't you working at AT&T in San Francisco for a while to try to raise money to come out here?
Not to raise money to come out here, to pay off my student loan. I didn't go to college very much, but I managed to run up a bill. And I pay my debts. So I worked for Ma Bell on Kearney and... what's his name, for a year. I promised him I'd work for him a year, because I took their test, you know, and the woman said, you know, we can't hire you because you did too well on your test, and we know that you won't stay with us. And I said, well, how long do I have to stay with you? And she said, well, you've got to commit to a year. So I took out my checkbook, showed her the balance, and said, this morning I made a decision. It was either the telephone company or the Tenderloin. Now it's balls in your court. And she hired me. And I did my year. And I paid off my student loan. And then I was free.
Tell me about the first day that you saw the property that you had bought and what your first impressions were.
There is a tree here we call Methuselah. It's huge. It's 19 feet in, what's the go-around, circumference at its base. You can walk around in it. It's huge. It is so beautiful, and it's an oracle oak. We had a forester look at it because one of the sides of the leaves is smooth and the other side is prickly. And so that's apparently a giveaway to being a hybrid. So it's a cross between a Canyon Oak and a California Live Oak. It's called an Oracle Oak, and it's a special thing. And you can't stand under its boughs without knowing that. And we felt as if we'd come home. And we felt safe. And it was good.
What was something that was happening in your life or in the world or the country at the time that made you decide that you didn't want to have a mainstream American life?
Well, Spiro Agnew got busted for graft. That was interesting. I mean, a whole bunch of things led up to it. Think about those years, you know, 65, 66, 67, 68. Everyone was just a ground mover. And you either moved with it or you dropped out further than you thought you were gonna. So, that is my history. I can live, I can tell you about it by conjuring up visions of places I've been and things I've done. But to make a coherent, linear statement about those years is not possible.
I think you told me a story about reading tarot cards for young men.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, here's the deal. I can do vignettes. I used to read tarot. I read my own cards when I'm feeling, you know, gutsy. And back then, I realized that I was seeing more than it was my business to see. So I stopped reading cards. And then I started reading cards again because it was during the days of the draft. And there were some people that had to know if their number was coming up or if they were off to Canada. And that was where it was at. And so those cards I read for that specific question. But that's the last time I've read cards for anyone else. It's a personal thing.
What were some of the first things you did when you made it up to this property? And can you talk about where the name of the property comes from?
Well, the original, see, here's the deal. I knew what I was looking at when I came here. And I knew that we had enough money to put down on 20 acres. But I also knew that everything else around us was for sale. And I knew that I had two choices. I could either live and buy a wee trailer home, not putting them down, just saying facts, or I could let other people know what the opportunities were here and basically hold an open house and sell them on buying the land. And they did. Some people bought land up here because their truck broke down. But most people brought land up here because they came and stayed for 2-3 weeks. I could show all the corners. I knew all the property lines. I knew this land. I'd studied it. And I knew where the water was. And people came. And then people stayed. And then I had always wanted to live on this particular 20 down in the hole. Because where I used to live up at the Frog Pond, where all the open houses and like that took place. Well, let's put it this way. One day I wandered off and I came down here to the hole and I felt safe. And I felt safe. And I mean, I know that this makes me sound slightly hysterical, but safety is a big issue in my world. I've lived really free all my life, but I've always been able to cover my rump in terms of safety, and I felt safe here, and that's why we built here. And you know, we threw the I Ching, and we ended up distilling from our throw that the house would have five sides, four wings and five rooms. So we built it according to what we had. Dave Raitt, he had just come out here from the East Coast. He had a sawmill, and we dropped a tree that had bug killed a year before, and he sawed it up on his mill, and we had X number of boards at X number of dimensions to do da-da. And so the house was built according to the wood that we had, which is why Wendy just now looked at a piece of the house that 45 years later it just got finished, because I finally ended up with a piece of wood that had fit there.
Can you describe the house that we're sitting in and what it took to build it?
Well, my partner had broke his back, and there was no such thing. I mean, I know that you don't think there's a road down here now, but you should have seen it then. And we milled the tree at Apache Flat, which is kind of a neighborhood flat area, duh. And flats at a premium around here. And got it hauled up to the Frog Pond, where I used to live. And then I dragged it down. And the cement and all of that on a skid from an old Volvo hood. Must have weighed a ton. And the only thing I had trouble with is occasionally it would start to chase me. And because it's a steep hill, right? And so then I would follow the skid on the way down. Boy, those were hairy times. I think about being so nimble now. It's hard to believe. The house itself cost in $2,000. That was in 1975. It's when we stamped the date in the concrete. It's built on boulders. And in each boulder, I had a star drill. You know what a star drill is? It's like a chisel, only it's got a star on the end. And it's made for making holes in boulders. And so I sank 5-inch holes in each one of the corner boulders. And with a star drill. And then had them blown out. And then I put rebar down in the hole and extending up to where I knew I was going to pour some cement to anchor the, are you with me? To anchor the cement to the boulder. And that's how each one of these corners is. And by George, that worked. We had an avalanche, and I'm here to tell the story. The avalanche went under the house, around on either side. And the house survived. Because we live in a hole. I live in a hole. This is a hole. And it's a whole hole. W-H-O-L-E. I'm complete here. I'm a part of the whole thing when I'm here. So here I am.
And you used a lot of recycled and scavenged materials to build the house, right?
Oh, hell yes. I mean, first of all, we milled that tree ourselves and then determined the dimensions of the tree or the house based upon what we had in wood. And then you could buy redwood 2x4 from the Philo Mill, $35 a 1,000 board feet. So wet you could wring it out, but boy, it would tighten up over a nail. And the dimensions were, you know, oddballs, but they were good. And then an old friend from the coast, Heilman, brought it over on his truck. Boy, that's a long time ago. And anyway, then we were also making friends with people in lumber yards and like that, not the owners, but the guy that worked in the yard. And we got a call one morning. Actually, what you did back then was you called a neighbor who would come up on his motorcycle and get us, or we would get a message over the CB to, you know, give this fellow a call. I think it was a CB. And so we went down to the neighbors and we called him, and he said, you know, I know where there's a truck dumped and it's got a whole load of CDX 3/4-inch plywood on it, and they're going to write it off on the insurance because it's so steep. It was on Highway 20 West. And, you know, there are places there that you look down and you're looking down a long way. It took us 3 days, but we salvaged it. We used a block and tackle. We had 4 stations of the cross where we could stop and get a better grip on what was happening and reposition the blocks and take it up another 12, 15 feet. But we got it. We got every single one. And all the plywood in this house is 3/4-inch CDX. And that's a good roof, good floor, good walls. Good trip.
And we were looking at a photograph before we got started. Can you talk about the photograph? Should we take it down again and look at it? Or?
No, I've sort of memorized that photograph. February 4th, 1974, a neighbor came down and put his hands on my arms and said, "Anon, I've got bad news." And I thought someone had died. And he said, "I was just up on the road, and there's a four-wheel drive Jeep up there. They got chains on all 4 wheels. They've dug themselves down into the road. They've got suits on and briefcases, and it doesn't look good." I told him, I says, "Well, what the hell did you do? You know, I mean," it was a pretty safe bet he wasn't going to help him out. And he said, "Well, I told him I was a college student out on a nature hike, and they seemed to go for that. So I just came on down here and thought I'd tell you what was going on." There were at this time maybe 8 or 9 families living up here. So he went back up and he took a couple neighbors with him, and they hid in the poison oak and listened to the way these folks from the county were talking about us and what they were going to do about us and what wicked people we were. So having heard everything they wanted to hear about that, they came on down to the house and told me. Well, that night, the whole neighborhood got together and shared their stories. People had had their houses red tagged, unfit for human occupancy, stay out, do wah, right? Duck house tagged, unfit for human occupation. I don't know. They thought the people were sleeping with the ducks or what the heck. But it was pretty awful. So anyway, that night we all got together in the barn where I lived with my partner Saul Crimsley. And we decided that we had 2 ways out. We could change the law, or we could move. And we decided to take the easy way out, and we changed the law. And it took 5 years through just slogging through the most horrendous social bigotry you can imagine. I mean, we had the bad luck of having Patty Hearst kidnapped the same week we were busted. And there was I'll never forget this, there's an editorial in the old Willits News describing us as people waiting up in the back hills, waiting our chance. Who knew for what? I mean, good Lord, we were evil. And we kind of brought it on ourselves because we knew our houses were illegal, so you didn't exactly tell anyone where you lived. I mean, in the neighborhood was one thing, but countywide was quite another, which certainly came as a shock when we started to organize, because we began to realize just how many of us there were. And it wasn't just Mid-Mountain. It was all over the whole damn county. There were just pockets of freaks everywhere. We used to park outside of a local mailbox. We'd sit outside the post office, and when someone came by that looked like us, we'd jump out and say, "Hey, this is happening to us. It's going to happen to you, right? We got to get ourselves together here." And that was the way we spread the word. We did that for 2 weeks. We just about lived in that car. We did live in the car. We had a mimeograph machine that we salvaged from the dump. And so we were mimeographing our story as we went along. And we had set it up for a community meeting at First Christian Church in Ukiah. Yeah, March 15th, I believe it was, of that year. And people just kept coming and coming and coming, and we filled the church. And we told them what had happened to us, what we were living in, what the conditions were, that we were fine. We were providing for ourselves and our family. It was no big deal, right? Everyone cheers. Everyone's doing the same thing. So we said, well, we'll volunteer. We'll see this through. We'll change the law. And you please put your name and your address and your phone number on a 3x5 card that's being passed around the room here. So, and you tell us what you're up for doing. If you're up for making a slideshow, we want to hear about it. If you're up for writing articles in the paper, we want to hear it. If you're up for helping run an office, because that's what it's going to take. There were over 300 people there. And several people got up and spoke, and that was a good thing. And then at the appointed hour of 8 o'clock, the flange of the county came in. They had been invited, of course. And they formed into two rows of two people abreast, six of them, and came down the center aisle. And we vacated. And they told us everything we've been doing wrong, that there was no hope. And that started the ball rolling, because you take hope away from people and there's all they got left, you know. You might as well dig in and fight. If there's no hope, hell, why not?
So talk about that photograph, the culmination of this 5 years effort.
4 years later. Would you mind if I got another beer?
Thank you. Well, naming it was a whole nother movie.
We didn't know who we were. Yeah, but we knew there were five of us. And that we were committed. We didn't have children. We didn't have... the partners that we had were of the five. And we had nothing to lose. We were last ditch. We had nothing. And we were going for something. So we got together. The guy named Dr. Zbitnov in Ukiah, nicest man. Zbitnov, more than you could chew, is what we used to tell him. He had this place on State Street and Smith. Yes, Smith and State. He owned all of those apartments above the old stationery store that used to be there years ago. And he liked what we were doing. He had read one of our mimeographed flyers. And he approached us and told us that he would be happy to rent to us. And so we had, bang, an office with a room that we could sleep in. Another one of us took over the job of managing the place because it was totally empty. I mean, it was not in good shape when we arrived. And it had been used by a lot of people for a lot of things. And Zbitnov wasn't getting paid for them. So anyway, we managed the place and we had our offices there. And we needed a name. We were talking about it, you know, and what came up was that, yeah, well, it's, what are we going to call us? We're just us. And one of us came up with, We are us. We're united. Stand. U.S. Us. We're us. It's them and us, but we're us. And we're gonna pull this off. And I'm telling you, it just kind of fell out of his mouth. And that's who we were. And we were definitely united. And boy, no one was sitting down. So there it was. It was a good name.
So you traveled a lot. You traveled to San Francisco, to Arto. You traveled to Sacramento. It wasn't just mobbing the Board of Supervisors meetings.
Well, first of all, we had to rally our base. And since we didn't really know the size of our population, which was a good thing, as I said, we stopped outside of post offices and contacted people about that first meeting. Then from that came a mailing list, and from that doors opened because everybody knew everybody and everyone knew how everybody was living. And so it was very easy to rally a crew of people. However, to do that, and I don't begrudge us, it was the experience of my lifetime. We had to go from community to community, from neighborhood to neighborhood, and we would give little seminars to maybe 5, 6, 7 neighbors, right, on who we were, what had happened to us, what we were all about, and like that. And we did that. Oh, I probably have visited 60 or 70 different neighborhoods in this county, from Whitethorn to Wallala, to Potter Valley, to Yorkville, to you name it, up north there, practically Humboldt, Piercy, California, Round Valley. We were everywhere. But it took a while to get us together because it was kind of like herding geese. You know, I mean, we were hiding up in the back hills. And our chance had come. So, that's that story.
And how did that story end?
Well, it took 5 years. Actually, it took 4 years to bring the county around our way of thinking. And the county, you know, bless its cowardly little butt, told us, well, it isn't our thing, it's the state's thing. You'll have to go straighten out the state law. So we girded our loins and went to Sacramento. Terry Brown was the governor then. Remember the first time we walked up to the steps of the big kahuna there, the Capitol? The Linda Ronstadt was on an outdoor speaker singing, I've been cheated, I've been mistreated, when will I be loved? And I said to myself, yes, this is a good sign, a good omen. Well, we ended up talking to a guy named Jacques Barjagi, who is a resident Zen monk. And these things just happened to us. And we met our congressperson, whose name isn't coming to me right now, but the Republican conservative was Peter Baer, marvelous man, understood the Constitution, four ways to everywhere. Barry Keene was the assembly person. And we made friends with them that day. And then we went down to the governor's office and said we would like to talk to him because Jacques Barjagi was with us. He did something, nodded or something, and a door buzzed, and we went into the inner sanctum. And we met Brown, who, you know, he... Governor Moonbeam was a whole nother critter than what he ended up being. He was just too cool. And we gave him our slideshow, and he called in all of his, what would you call them, secretaries... You know, different, the heads of different departments like transportation and and building standards and so on and yada da. And we were all sitting around the table and we showed him the slideshow. And at the end of it, Jerry Brown said, "Well, what do you want?" And no one had asked us that. I mean, we were used to running from, not running toward, right? And we said, "Well, no one's ever asked us that." And he said, "Well, tell me, what do you want? Do you want to go home?" And I said, "Yeah, we want to go home." And he said, "Right now, tonight, if you can arrange it." And then we took off. We met these people that were there. It was like 1 a.m. And he was called Governor Moonbeam for more than one reason, I'll tell you. And he told this person do this, this person do this, this person do that. You check on that, see how far we can push that, etc. And we knew that we were standing in the bowels of power. And it was awesome. And so then he appointed me to the Housing and Community Development Department. I was a commissioner there. There were 9 commissioners in the state. And I had full investigatory powers and a complete staff, which was really kind of cool because I got to double back to Mendocino County and find out just how many people with which last names were really running farm worker housing outfits without being registered on the books, and the conditions that those people were living in, and how no one was saying a word because they were too busy chasing the hippies in the hills or something like that. So I got quite an education, and then we passed it. That's what that picture is. It was about a year, took about a year. We passed it through the Housing and Community Development Commission. Then we passed it on to the Building Standards Commission, and Governor appointed me to that because I was the shepherd, right? Got it through there, no problem. Few glitches, you know, people get nervous. People get nervous. You can't blame them for that. They were living sinecures, and life was easy. So sure, they wanted to hang on to their seats. But the signs were on the wall. The governor said, "Go." And, you know, just like governor says, "Frog," and you jump. That was how it was there. And so we passed it to the Building Standards Commission. And it became law.
What was it that became law?
The Class K category for housing in the state of California. See, here's the deal. We have housing codes, but the housing codes don't speak to heating your home with wood. They don't speak to having your studs 2x4s instead of 2x6 because you milled it yourself and it's an actual 2x4. And like that, the codes are, they're made by three main interests. First of all, there's a construction industry, which is the contractors' associations. Everyone's got an association, don't kid yourself. It makes them look good. Then we have the unions. Lord help us from the unions. Now, the union members at that time, I don't know how it is now, but at that time, the union members couldn't afford their own product. They didn't like the fact that these hippies were out there in the hills building a house by themselves out of many things, many of them like plastic piping that any fool could take out, repair, and put back in without tearing out an entire wall and so on. I mean, I can get pretty heated on this. But that's two of them. And the building inspectors themselves. Now, check this out. This is the racket they've got going. The building inspectors themselves write the law. They do it in an open public meeting without the public being invited. Only representatives of industry and the unions. No public. No, just plain old want to build a house person. And they decide what the law is going to be. It is not an accident that Owens Corning was the only one to show up when R11 and R13, when R11 and 6-inch studs became the law of the land around here. You know, they were the only ones that were selling it. They were the only ones that showed. Those industries invite the building inspectors to go on their, what's it call it, conventions in places like Hawaii and bring the fam on the ticket of the either the building inspectors organization or fraternity or the ticket of the industry that is sponsoring them. Sponsoring is a very popular name in this game. And like that. And then you sit across the table from the person representing the company that just paid for your ticket to Hawaii and the family for 2 weeks in the sun, and you're going to vote against that person's interests? I don't think so, Al. And that was exactly what was going down. And I uncovered all of that. And only the threat of exposure got Class K passed. Because no one that I've just run down the list, contractors, unions, whatever, want to hear anything about corruption in the system. Least of all, the building inspectors themselves. It's as if the building inspectors get together once a year and decide what the speed limit is going to be within their jurisdiction and then make their departments and salaries dependent upon how many tickets they issue. That is exactly what's going on.
So you just talked about how hard you fought to preserve this life that you made for yourself up here, but we haven't really talked much about what that life is like. You said you've got a spring here, and you described a little bit of the landscape, but what is it about moving back to the land that made you so determined to stay where you were? What is it that you love about it?
Well, see, I have never stayed where I was. I've been moving all my life. And something that I always have carried in my heart is looking at a well 4 inches in diameter, bricked by hand, that my grandmother and grandfather dug. She pulled up the buckets. He loaded them. It's 32 feet deep. They got seepage. They called it quit, and the well came in that night. I'll never forget that. I've been able to look down that well and know what they did. They raised 11 kids and sent them all through either college or normal school, it was called then, or apprenticed them to a trade. 11 kids. Those are the ones that lived. I know where my family's graveyard is, and it's full of babies. It's full of people from the 1918 flu epidemic, you know? And it's full of more, I don't know, what would you call them? Current people, I guess? I don't know, but I've got roots there in North Dakota. And I know what is possible. And I know that I've always known that I had to own my own land. That was critical to my heart. That I had to own the land I was standing on and proposing to change around according to the way I thought it should be. I got over that. So that was just it. I mean, when I came to Mid-Mountain, well, first of all, when I lived at Rivendell on the coast, you know, I knew that living rough, and I'm telling you, we lived rough, was for me. Prior to that, I lived in Golden Gate Park in Hippie Gulch for a few months. That kind of tempered me, my way of looking at things, too. So, then Rivendell, then the Frog Pond, then here in the hole. And here in the hall, I'll stay. This is it, folks. I'm 74. I'm done moving.
Can you talk about some of your animal neighbors?
Well, everything lives around here. Probably the most stunning critter that coasts on by is the mountain lion. I have a little koi pond outside. Just a little, you know, pond with fish in it. And she comes up and waters there in the dead of summer, usually August, deep September, and into October, depending upon what's going on in the world. And she twerps before she comes up. She makes this twerping sound. It's like a chirp. It doesn't growl or anything like that, but I know that she's coming because she always comes up the creek bed, and the sound travels up the creek bed, and I can hear her coming. And so that's when the kids and I go in the house, or if it's just me, I go in the house. I give her a lot of space. She runs, I pay 150 pounds. And, if I'm lucky, the cat will take me out when my time comes because it's a clean kill. Anyway, we got that. I got that. I've got three bears right now. The Wildlife Commission, whatever it is, Fish and Game used to be, say that the bear population has increased threefold in the past 5 years because people don't hunt bear anymore or consider it fit to eat. Now, it's greasy, I'll give you that. But there are things that you can do with bear meat. I've considered it. I kind of know my bears. So it would be like offing Aunt Matilda so that the family could survive. But I don't know. It's in the offing. It depends, you know. I mean, if it comes right down to it, I'm used to living on the edge. And I can live on that edge. So then we got bobcats. So I told you about the bobcat looking in the window at me. We couldn't believe each other's eyes. He looked at me, I looked at him. And we were about a foot apart, eye to eye. Awesome. And then you saw what the bear did to my porch screens. I mean, it comes in one way and it goes out the other. I tend to sleep. When the bear is really active, you can bet that I don't keep anything that would possibly tempt a bear, being it leftover stashed plastic bags or anything. I mean, you got to be neat and clean to live around a bear. And they'll still go through one window and out the other. I sleep with a .38 when there's more of them than I can handle. And I get nervous. And it's single shot. Double aught buck. So I'm going to have the barrel up one nostril. But I'm pretty sure I can take care of that. I don't want to hurt anything. I don't hurt my rattlesnake. I've had a rattlesnake living underneath the bathtub for years. And she's had babies under there. And, you know, rattlesnakes, their babies are born alive. And the mom rattlesnakes hangs out with the babies for, you know, 2, 3, 4 days. I think then until they get over their tendency to cannibalize each other. And then they all go off in different directions. Sometimes you'll see two or three in one place, but that's unusual. They're pretty solitary. And they're beautiful. They're so brightly colored. And they've got these little tiny buttons on the end of their tails. Anyway, she's lived underneath the bathtub there for 4, 5, 6 years anyway. She hibernates under there, and I think she likes it because it's an outdoor bathtub for an outdoor shower, and it gets really hot because it's solar. And I think that she likes occasionally having her back thaw out, you know, underneath there. There's something that attracts her there. Anyway, now she calls it home. I do too. Skunks. A lot of skunks. Striped skunks. Cutest little skunks in the world. Love cat food. Possums. You always know it's a possum because they can't really close their mouth when they eat. So it's kind of a, you know. And it's like Dr. Doolittle's here in the wintertime. Things come in, have a bite. One time, I was sitting with some friends, and we were down in the bottom room where there's a cat door. And we were sitting around bullshitting, and it was all okay. And a gopher snake comes in the cat door and goes behind the stove and rears up about 2 feet in the air. I swear to God, it looked at each person there like it was counting them, decided there were too many, curled back, and went back out the cat door. That really happened, and it was obvious that it wasn't that snake's first foray into the house. It knew exactly where it was and what was going on. And I believe it came in sometimes, like the alligator lizards, they come in to catch the mice if my cat falls down on the job or has her nails trimmed back.
Didn't you have civet cats in here once, too?
No, that's a standing joke, civics cats. It's too involved to get into. But the little spotted skunks are tiny. And they're extremely active. The only thing you got going for you with a spotted skunk, they weren't civet cats. I called them that by accident. I recall this now. No, they were spotted skunks, and they can't jump. And it's the only thing you got going for you, because if you can keep things up off the floor, the skunk is not going to get into it because it can't jump. So there's that.
And what about the mud dauber? We had a mud dauber in here participating in the interview for a little while, but now she's gone. Can you talk about some encounters with the mud daubers?
You know, I've kept bees, and I got really close to insects when I did that. And I don't like to just wantonly off something. It's just not my nature. So I let the mud daubers and the paper wasps, and I'm not so strong on yellow jackets, but we'll get to that. The bald-faced hornets, I leave things alone, and it all works out. Now, there's some mud daubers that live here in a house, and I know where they live, and I know that they make these great little mud dauber cells. And they don't bother anybody. They're just minding their own business. So one day, I'm in the bottom room. I come in the house. I'm walking up the steps. And a mud dauber hits me right smack in the face on the cheek with a mouthful of mud. And I'm telling you, they can pack. So I just froze. I didn't know quite what to do about that. And I just froze. And she came back, and she gathered up her mud. I could feel her little hands and arms working, making it back into a ball that she could lift. And then she lifted it, and then she got airborne, and then she went to where she was making her mud dauber heaven. And it taught me a real lesson in a lot of things, patience not being the least of them. I like my critters. I like everything that lives here. You know, if you can be in one place long enough to watch the trees grow, you've done a beautiful thing. Whether your life could be called useful or not, productive or not, I mean, that's all judgments that are made in other people's minds. When you're faced with a problem, fix it. You're worth your salt when you fix it. And here, problems get fixed.